And you have our theme text right in your bulletin there from Psalm 7 and 11. God judges the righteous, and God is angry with the wicked every day. Until we take up our series in the Psalms, just to remind you, I am taking up and reshaping some of our radio spots and putting them here before you. I know some of you don't get opportunity to listen to those, so I want to sample, at least in the weeks ahead, some of those things the Lord has laid on my heart for our radio ministry. In that regard, I've been wrestling for years with the nature of evil and how it relates to government. So that is the theme for the next several weeks. How do we identify evil? Christians should be able to do this, right? And how do we spot it and how do we identify it when it lurks around us? In 1961, a reporter covered the Adolf Eichmann trial. Eichmann, some of you remember him, a Nazi official who organized the efficient extermination of Europe's Jews under Adolf Hitler. The reporter's name was Hannah Arendt, and she was herself a German-born Jewess who struggled to come to grips with not only the destruction of European society, but also the nature of evil that could spawn such things. She asked, where does evil come from? Why do people commit evil acts? How are those people different from the rest of us? And her biographer says, and I quote him, her conclusions were profound. People who do evil are not necessarily monsters. Sometimes they're just bureaucrats. The Eichmann, she observed, he goes on to say, on trial was neither brilliant nor a sociopath. He was described by the attending court psychiatrist as, quoting the psychiatrist now, a completely normal man, more normal at any rate than I am after examining him. Evil, Arendt suggests, can be extraordinary acts committed by otherwise unremarkable people, unquote. This unremarkable characteristic of evil that she denominated, she calls the banality of evil. The banality of evil. That which is banal is commonplace, normal, prosaic. Eichmann was a thin, plain, ordinary-looking man with thick glasses who would be unrecognizable in a crowd. He was raised in a Lutheran church of average intelligence with no personality that would attract a stray dog, much less adoring crowds like his Mostow, Adolf Hitler. But that which attracted him to Hitler and Himmler, too, Himmler is the one who really recruited him, was his systematic, efficient approach to everything he did. Sometimes evil people are just bureaucrats, right? In the closing days of World War II, when the final solution to the Jewish question begged an answer, Eichmann offered his part in it. Just as cockroaches could be sprayed with dust when collected in one place, so Jews could be sprayed with a Zyklon B, a cyanide-based chemical, in the showers of the prison camps. Just as sheep could be herded to slaughter by Judas goats who led them up the ramp to the butcher, so Jews could be led to the camps by the rabbis and civic leaders in Germany. The Jews of Europe, disarmed, very important, disarmed, did you hear, herded into ghettos where they were easily controlled and numbed in spirit and mind by decades of propaganda, they were cowed into a Holocaust, not compelled. Evil in that day was banal, not sensational. There were no cackling demons prancing around with pitchforks and pointy tails. Only efficient bureaucrats with clipboards and swastikas. How does this happen? There were no Frankenstein monsters ripping apart the bodies of Jews. Only the local residents, villages of Bergen-Belsen and Auschwitz, burying the bodies of the Jews killed in the showers. You see film of that once the Allies came through? Evil. We expect evil things and deeds to come to us like the Gadarene demoniac, right? howling, bloody, tearing chains from off their body, when in truth, evil is more often a pasty shade in the shadows, like Gollum. Didn't Tolkien get evil so well in his trilogy, did he not? Evil is far more like Gollum than it is like the Gadarene demoniac or Frankenstein. Pale, pasty, this is what evil does to you eventually, does it not? What is the nature of evil? What is it? How do we recognize it when we see it? It's not as easy as you think. How do we recognize it in individuals, in ourselves perhaps, and in groups, especially evil in governments that represent us and rule over us? Can we say our present government is evil and explain clearly why? How do we combat evil? How do we destroy evil without becoming evil ourselves? Another problem Tolkien dealt with in his trilogy, too. Dear listener, the history of man is the history of evil government, with a few notable exceptions. Generation after generation of Egyptian peasant, for example, 3,000 years of the dynasties of Egypt. Generation after generation of peasant lived and died in the rice paddies of the Nile, while the Pharaoh and his priestly class cruelly, cynically oppressed them, lived lives of luxuries themselves. Religion was used as a tactic of fear and control, where knowledge was power. Mel Gibson's Apocalypto, no film for children, by the way, but is a chronicle of how evil is used, is it not, to dominate people. Knowledge is power. Knowledge of the sun and the lunar movements could predict the solar eclipse by the Aztec priests, and they used it to dominate their people as well. The Egyptians did the very same things. In fact, the very model of satanic cultism is modeled still today after how the Egyptians practiced it. The order of the Egyptian dawn, resourced, unearthed, literally, by Aleister Crowley, who was self-characterized in the 19th century as the most evil man alive. He was proud of this, and he enjoyed doing evil. There are people out there, we recoil at the thought of this, but there are people that get up in the morning, as the psalmists say, they lay on their beds concocting and planning evil for the next day. They rise in the morning in order to do evil enthusiastically. Aleister Crowley was such a man. The Masons, the LDS Temple Rites, many LDS do not even know this, but LDS Temple Rites are characterized, are modeled after the Masons, which in turn are modeled after the satanic rituals of the Order of the Egyptian Dawn. The kings of Babylon, Assyria, Persia were pagan kingdoms who led by definition devilish satanic gods they had, Baal, Ashtoreth, Chemosh, whom they served, to the groaning oppression of their peoples. The peoples under Islam for over a millennia lived lives of poverty and ignorance and death, while the so-called caliph and his few lord it over them in the name of Allah. Even in the West, under so-called Christian princes, the kingdoms of Europe were too often characterized by evil kings, the papacy, crushing their subjects with taxes, brutality, and cruel laws. The history of mankind, if you read history, and you must, if you will understand these things, has been the story of evil. Why? Why? Why do evil people gravitate to government? When asked why he robbed banks, John Dillinger quipped, "Because that's where the money is." For men like Chairman Mao, Joseph Stalin, Adolf Hitler, they might answer when asked, "Why government?" "Because that's where the power is." Right? As we have observed over the last few weeks, rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. The ruler is God's servant for your good. Premise here is that the ruler is doing good. Principles of righteousness, principle of God's law, if you will. If you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is the servant of God and avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. As we unpack that, we saw that Paul premises his subjection to rulers on the premise that they are doing good, i.e., they are following God's law, if you will, even if it is primitively planted in our hearts according to the principles of natural law, right? But often with historical hindsight, we see how evil men gravitate to government because that's where the power is. Only a precious few governments could be considered righteous and good. Israel, when she was born, was modeled after a tribal republic. And when her leaders were godly, life was free, righteous, and prosperous for all. England developed as a Christian parliamentary republic as her traditions of liberty accumulated over the centuries in documents like the Magna Carta, the English Bill of Rights. And of course, at her founding, the United States was governed by wise, godly men who gave us a constitutional republic. But these are few and far between, and we should count ourselves blessed and fortunate to at least be in the wake, at least be in the tail end of these things, if it survives. Yet recently I've had a haunting suspicion lurking in my soul that our present system of governance, more than misguided, mismanaged, and misdirected, I've been forced by the evidence before my eyes to ask, is the government of the United States evil? I don't want to be sensational or dramatic. No sweeping generalizations or blanket condemnations of all within government, certainly not. What I do wish to explore is the nature of evil, its relation to how we govern ourselves as people. Evil doesn't always come with horns, cloven hooves, a haughty laugh, does it? Sometimes with a sweet smile and assuring words. Can we identify and define evil? How does it manifest itself in the individual and then in groups too? Groups that culminate in the profound institution we call government. So before we go slinging around the toxic term evil, that's easy to do, isn't it? Let's have a clear idea of what it is. I'll give you my working definition of evil and then I will justify it for you, okay? My working definition of evil. The active personal state of the soul. This is a soul matter. The active personal state of the soul consciously set against God and His program. Very important component. Consciously set against God and His program, characterized by narcissism, rebellion, and deceit. Once again, the active personal state of the soul consciously set against God and His program, characterized by narcissism, rebellion, and deceit. Those are the tells of evil. Our secular society, despite the evidence exploding all around them, they're afraid to use this term evil for several reasons. Go to your library, look this article up. It's still, I haven't found anything better than Lance Morrow. Lance Morrow is an excellent journalist. I think he's retired now. But in 1991, June of 91, he wrote the cover article for Time magazine. And it has one of those foreboding covers, you know, gray, and it has in black letters on the cover, evil! Because it's undeniable. It's in our world. How does the world define and handle evil? And what we find, when we do define evil and good apart from God, is that we invariably get it wrong, and we pay a heavy price as a race for doing this. If you are to intelligently cope with a problem and solve it, you must first identify it. How has modern secular society identified evil, so-called? First of all, Morrow says, about evil, he says, such terms needlessly empower the idea of God. You can tell where he's coming from. Such terms as evil needlessly empower the idea of God, who, after all, does not enjoy universal recognition. No, Lance. He goes on to say, is it possible that evil is a problem that is more intelligently addressed outside the religious context of God and Satan? Unquote. This is how he approaches the topic. He gives three broad secular definitions of evil, the most popular one being that of the well-known 19th century humanist William James, who rejected the Bible. He says, evil is a disease. Evil is a disease, to his mind. It's become the pat answer of modern psychiatry, too. Evil was reduced to a mental illness that could be cured by the treatment of modern science. Ha! Tell that to the 6 million victims of the Holocaust, the 56 million of Stalin's own people in the Soviet Union, the over 100 million of his own people slain by Chairman Mao in China. An anemic diagnosis, if I might say. Because we see evil thriving as never before after almost two centuries of treating it as a disease. Well, Mr. Morrow himself adopts the evolutionary model, suggesting that evil is an immanence in the world, in the mind, arising from the collective unconscious, unquote. This view sees evil as an outmoded survival instinct that served to preserve the individual in his primitive state, but which is now destructive to the survival of the species at large, as we must now cooperate and sacrifice in order to propagate. The evolutionary model. And of course, the famous cynic, the writer, Holocaust survivor, Elie Wiesel, questions whether there can be a good God in the face of the Holocaust. Even if there is a God, according to him, he will not come to deliver us from evil. Wiesel says, God is in exile, but every individual, if he strives hard enough, can redeem mankind and even God himself. How delusional, Ellie. Can the drowning man save himself? Can the dead man burst the bonds of his grave unaided? Who can flap his arms and fly away in a free fall, huh? Tell that to the demon-possessed man who howled amongst the tombs of the Decapolis in Jesus' day. It was only the liberating words of the Savior, Jesus of Nazareth, that could deliver him. And it's true for us, too. The only accounting for evil that gives us the apt and proportional picture is the one portrayed in the Bible, where we see evil personified in a real, personal, supernatural creature. And without this, you will not get it right. Who is he? John in the Apocalypse says, the dragon, that ancient serpent who is the devil or Satan. Just as the good and the righteous is personified ultimately in the eternal God of the Bible, beautiful in his holiness, so evil and wickedness is personified in a created being, the devil, ultimately ugly and powerless. How weak is evil in the long run? It may come on as strength and power, and people sell their souls for it, but in the end, it is weak and pasty and dead. But the devil, he is the active personal soul consciously set against God and his program, as we have in our definition, our working definition of evil. He is that active personal soul consciously set against God and his program. And all evil looks either more or less like this personification of evil. The Bible tells us frankly of Satan's aspirations. In Isaiah 14, you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. You see the personal lust for power. I will sit enthroned on the Mount of Assembly, on the utmost heights of the sacred mountain. This is the whisper of the narcissist. I will ascend above the tops of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. This is the heart of evil, the desire to be God, to supplant and replace him, the overweening pride and self-love. One perceptive author calls narcissism. The Bible confirms it. Ezekiel 28 says, you were the model of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. You were anointed as a guardian cherub. You were on the holy mount of God. You were blameless in your ways from the day you were created till evil was found in you. Narcissism. Narcissism is egocentrism, the Oxford English Dictionary. Love or desire for one's own self. It is the inability to see beyond the importance, the exaltation of anyone or anything than oneself, almost be sacrificed to its needs and desires. The narcissist cannot put down the mirror, cannot put down the megaphone speaking of himself, cannot tolerate any put down either, for that matter, of what he is and does. Additionally, and importantly, the suffering of other beings matters nothing. In fact, pleasure is taken in the suffering of others to the narcissist, to the malignant narcissist. In fact, if the suffering of another contributes in any small way to my own well-being, then so much the better. Chairman Mao used to feast while watching the torture of his enemies, used to enjoy it. Stalin did the same thing. He would go down into Beria's prisons and watch his enemies being tortured and get pleasure from it. These are extreme cases of narcissism that psychiatrists label malignant narcissism. How devil-like, how evil. But there are people out there precisely like this. They explain some of the cruel behavior in the broad range of cults and secret societies to the rituals of animal and human sacrifice. Well, from that moment on, when evil was found in you, Satan, the morning star, that's the meaning of the word Lucifer, has actively opposed God and all for which he stands at every turn. This is why we say evil opposes all of God's program. In fact, the very word Satan is derived from the Hebrew Satan, meaning adversary. From Zechariah 3, chapter 1, then the angel showed me Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan, that is adversary, standing at his right side to accuse him. Peter refers directly to this when he says, be self-controlled and alert, for your adversary, Satan, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. Evil opposes all of God's program. It is its adversary. It's Satan. If God creates man upright in a blessed Garden of Eden, then Satan and all that is evil, those who are evil, oppose it and tempt the man and woman to sin and bring the blight of curse to it. If God reveals his perfect will in his law, the Ten Commandments, so that man may obey it and please him, Satan opposes it and tempts man to transgress that law. If God purposes to save men from eternal death, then Satan opposes it, seeks to divert as many souls from salvation as possible. Evil, viscerally, constitutionally, by nature, hates and reviles all that God is as its polar opposite, darkness for light, death for life, evil for good. He is that dragon, that ancient serpent, who is the devil or Satan. The embodiment, the personification, the epitome of what we define as evil. The active personal state of the soul consciously set against God and his program, characterized by narcissism, rebellion, and deceit. Now here I want to make a careful distinction between evil and what characterizes all of humanity in a generic sense. That is sin and transgression. In that sense, all men are evil, small e, but there is a capital E. We as fallen sinners, that is all human beings that have ever been born as a product of our nature, break God's law as a matter of course, as a natural outgrowth of who we are. We sin and transgress God's law. We do it without thinking, if you will, as a natural byproduct of our nature. We sin like a leopard grows spots, like a thorn bush produces thorns, like a sulfur pit belches foul yellow gas. It doesn't excuse or mitigate our sin in any way. We will all be accountable for it in the day of judgment. It will send us to hell unless it is dealt with at the cross in Jesus Christ. But it is different from the pure evil of which I speak here. The active personal state of the soul consciously set against God. Most men go to hell like unwitting cattle being herded by a rancher on market day, like lemmings sweeping over the cliff, the instinct of their species, like cockroaches spilling over the log into the campfire. But not so other men. Other men go willingly, with eyes wide shut, having consciously in their lives practiced evil, enjoyed it, having exultantly indulged in what they knew in their superego to be wickedness, knowing full well they serve a Lord at war with God. And they are everywhere. Business, arts, entertainment, and religion, and yea, government, since that's where the power is. And these are those of whom I speak when I define evil as the active personal state of the soul consciously set against God. Oftentimes, these are those who are the ranchers, if you will, herding the souls of other men into hell, the alpha lemmings leading the charge over the cliff into hell, the fittest of the species of the cockroach, first over the edge of the log into the fires of hell. In other words, they are the false shepherds of whom Jesus speaks, who shepherd not sheep into green pastures and still waters, but false shepherds who guide goats into scorched earth and putrid pools. They're among us everywhere. Business, arts, entertainment, religion, and yea, in governments. That's where the power is. Well, then, how do we identify evil? What are the tells of evil? Do we know evil when we see it? Or are we like cattle and lemmings and cockroaches? So many of our fellow citizens are. The Christian must be responsible to identify it, know it when he sees it. This is what I mean when I observe that evil also is characterized by narcissism, rebellion, and deceit. The personality of evil, the tells of evil, the properties of evil, if you will. Now, I owe much of this to the reflections of the Christian psychiatrist M. Scott Peck. Now, this is an older, from the 90s, right? People of the Lie, The Hope for Healing Human Evil, M. Scott Peck. But this, I haven't found anything better. If you have found anything better, contemporary description of evil, let me know. He dealt with evil in the army. He was an army psychiatrist for the longest time, and then in private practice as well. He says that evil is characterized by narcissism. Satan is absorbed in self. His minions are absorbed in self. You remember how Lucifer, that sweet angel of light, was created by God. You were the model of perfection, full of wisdom, perfect in beauty, anointed a guardian cherub, blameless in your ways. It is the inability to see beyond the importance or the exaltation of anything or anyone than oneself. All must be sacrificed to the needs and desires of self. The narcissist cannot put down the mirror, cannot put down the megaphone speaking of himself, cannot tolerate any put down of himself in what he does or says. It happens individually, and it happens in groups as well. Have you ever known a narcissistic person? My first narcissist I met, I didn't know what narcissist was, but later on when I said, oh, yes. They may smile or charm you in order to solicit your attention and affection. From there on in, your relationship becomes a one-way highway of adoration and worship, if it continues at all. Whatever morsels of humanity that may drop from them to you are so that the spigot of your essence to them might continue to flow. Perhaps you've dated a person like this, or God forbid, married such a person. You have my sympathy, if you did. Joseph Stalin was such a man, a narcissist, but even charmed that sly fox Winston Churchill. But he was a monster. When you look deeply into the narcissist's eyes, there's a hollowness as you look for a person and you realize they're staring deeply into your eyes in order to see themselves reflected in them. It is as if they look past your humanity in order to gaze upon their own inhumanity. Conversation, attention, whether individually or in a group, must gravitate largely to themselves or they're soon bored and inattentive. Praise, recognition, kudos must be lavished in one way, shape, or form for the narcissist's ego to remain afloat. Chairman Mao, once again, was one of these. He would politely, meekly receive the adoration lavished upon him when he entered a room, but he'd also become bored and leave if the room was not riveted on him at all times. Conversely, no whiff of criticism or rejection can be tolerated by the narcissist, whether it's deserved or especially undeserved criticism. Most well-adjusted adults can receive a measure of honest, well-meaning criticism without any damage to their self-image and ego. In fact, the truly humble, maturing person knows that he can grow and become a better person by taking to heart criticism that rings true. Not so the narcissist. Rage, tears, stammering protest, excuse-making, blame-setting, brooding fury characterize the response of the narcissist to even the mildest criticism or even teasing, perhaps. The narcissist may strike out petulantly, immediately, or brood silently until a more opportune moment to strike back presents itself. But make no mistake, the narcissist never forgets. One of the stars of our high school football team was such a kid. Many a teammate got black eyes for crossing him, too. Hitler was such a petulant narcissist, renowned for his tantrums and vengeance to his critics. Perhaps the most fearful aspect of the narcissist's personality is the inability for empathy. Peck brings this up eloquently. The inability for empathy. The impossibility of putting oneself in another's place to imagine their human experience. The narcissist is so self-absorbed that he cannot imagine another person feeling, another suffering, another in pleasure, pain, happiness, or misery. All that is real is how they experience these things, that they experience the range of humanity. The kid that pulls the wings off of flies, splashes gasoline on cats, and lights them will one day grow up to pull out the eyes of men as Beria did in the dungeons of the Soviet Union secret police, or Dr. Mengele operating on Jews without anesthesia just to see how the human responded in such conditions. The narcissist stalks the human race. The malignant narcissist stalks the human race, characterizing evil, appears individually and in groups. We'll look at that next week more closely, and in governments. Evil, then, secondly, is also characterized by rebellion. Satan was a rebel against God from the beginning. There was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon and his angels fought back. But he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. He was hurled to the earth, and his angels with him. This spirit of rebellion has characterized evil. Evil men are rebels against God and his law, and they are proud of it. For me, this is a test. What do you think of God's law? What do you think of God's law? Hopefully, as a Christian, you're growing, you're maturing, it becomes ever sweeter, does it not? Especially as you conform more and more into the image of the Son that has saved you, and your heart becomes more receptive to that law, more obedient to that law, and you see that sweet light, its righteousness, its goodness, its efficacy, its power in your life as Christ has obeyed it perfectly and now enables you be more and more conformed to that law, how sweet it becomes, does it not? What do you think of God's law? Some men squirm and chafe, scoffing at religion, the outmoded nature of the tribal law of Israel. Even poorly taught Christians will downplay and demean the law of God, thinking that they've transcended it now in grace, and think that they exalt grace by doing so. Without subtracting from grace one iota, we can affirm with David, "Oh, how I love your law! It is my meditation all day long." And it will not take long in the presence of an evil person to unmask the rebel in his soul. This is what we mean by rebellion. There will be a spirit of tumult and questioning of authority, unless that authority is imposed by him, and then watch out. Here is the narcissist, one with the rebel. He is one with the rebel here. He will counsel rebellion and revolution against you and God's law, but demand strict adherence to his regime at the price of your head. Sign of an evil tyrant. We see such personalities in the workplace, the neighborhood, the church, and lo, the government, because that's where the power is. This is tyrannical, Luciferian, socialistic, and communistic. The swarm of humanity around the Tower of Babel was a rebellion against the command of God, be fruitful and increase in number, filling the earth and subduing it. Instead, man concentrated themselves in place and numbers and aspired to subdue heaven rather than the earth given them. And since then, heaven is replete with rebellion. Israel, the French Revolution, the Bloody Terror, the Communist Revolution, even the rebellious 60s in the United States. All of these, in one way, shape, or form, were rebellions against God and evil. The rebel stalks the human race. The malignant narcissist stalks the human race, characterizing evil. He appears individually. He appears in groups. He is one of the psychiatrists that investigated the My Lai incident. Some of you gray hairs may remember the My Lai incident with us, with Lieutenant Callie. He was one of the psychiatrists who interviewed and analyzed the behavior of that group under those particular circumstances. The rebel, the malignant narcissist, stalks the human race, characterizing evil, appears individually and in groups and low in governments. He can be identified as a person, a potentate, a president, or an entire people. Thirdly, evil is also characterized by lies and deceit. By lies and deceit. Jesus got it precisely right. He was a murderer from the beginning, speaking of the father of the Pharisees, not holding to the truth, for there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks his native language, for he is a liar and the father of lies. Is this not the signature characteristic of the evil person and the evil institution? Lies. If you like your plan, you can keep your plan, period. If you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor, period. The average person will save $2,500 per year. The serpent lied to our first parents in the Garden of Eden, and his minions have been copying him ever since. Satan told Adam and Eve, if you like your soul, you can keep it, period. If you like your God, you can keep him, period. Your eyes will be open, knowing good and evil. Perhaps you know an evil person. If you do, then you have come to mistrust all that he says and tells you, right? Understanding that when the evil person lies, he speaks his native language. Be wary. Use discretion. The devil and evil does not always come to us cloaked in darkness, smelling of fire and brimstone, does he? The Apostle Paul warns us of false apostles, masquerading as apostles of Christ, and no wonder, for Satan himself masquerades as an angel of light, he says. Such that one of his names, Lucifer, means light bearer. The devil and evil does not always come to us as Mephistopheles and Faustus, does he? Waiting to drag us down to hell. But often as a sweet benefactor. I will give you all the kingdoms of the world. How many men have sold their souls for these things? I will give you all of the kingdoms of the world, their authority and splendor. This is the promise of political power. For it has been given to me, and I can give it to anyone I want to. So if you worship me, it will all be yours. And indeed, many have fallen for that lie, have they not? Well, then how are we to respond? John puts it very simply, and there's a great deal of power in this. The reason Jesus Christ appeared is to destroy the works of the devil. The reason Jesus Christ appeared is to destroy the works of the devil, and he is about doing that. Always understand that in the end, evil is weak and pasty and dead, and has no power over you as a Christian. Because, and this is the only answer, brothers and sisters, all other roads will lead to hell. All other roads will lead to subjection to evil in one way, shape, or form. Open your eyes. The reason Jesus Christ appeared is to destroy the works of the devil. He's about doing that in your life now, is he not? So many can testify to this. Trust in him. Go to goodness. See the beauty of goodness. See the beauty of goodness that is alive in God, in Christ, by the power of the Holy Spirit. Christ is building his kingdom, and he will triumph. But the battle still rages, doesn't it? We are still in a battle, and there's no time off. There's no time behind the lines. We are in the trenches as Satan labors to build a false kingdom. Learn to identify it. Learn to spot evil where it lurks. Identify it and defeat it with the tools that we've been given, right? In, as Paul tells us in Ephesians, the armor of God, the full armor of God. and we will be able to defeat it. Christ is building his kingdom and will triumph. He will triumph in you and using you. Well, let us then come to that place where we find grace, then to stand, find grace to fight. We see the beauty of righteousness. We see the beauty of God's law. We see the beauty of all of these things reflected in Christ as we come to the bread and cup of the supper of the Lord.